KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Army veteran Ivan Okan grew up in Las Cruces. Despite being a permanent resident of the United States, he was deported after serving a prison sentence. I talked with Okan about his effort to become a U.S. citizen and return home. We began our conversation with Okan's decision to join the Army after graduating from high school in Las Cruces.
I served from 97 to 2004, almost 7 years. I deployed to Operation Iraqi Freedom in 03 to Jordan. I love the military. That was like right out of high school. I said, that's the only thing I thought about doing, join the military, serve my country. I loved it, man. It's just one of those things. Believe me, they told me if I wanted to go back right now, you want to join the Army, I would. I would do it again, just if that's what it took.
And tell me why you loved it so much.
Well, it just, when I joined, it gave me a purpose in life. I came from a poor family, middle class. My mom had 2-3 jobs, and it was my way of, it helped me out to serve the country. It gave me purpose in life. And at the same time, I was able to help my mom back out at home and my siblings. But I loved it. It was a great experience. I got to travel everywhere in the service, different deployments, stationed at different places. So it's just an awesome experience.
And I guess you mentioned twice in your answer, serving the country, that was something important to you, that gave you that purpose.
Correct.
Tell me about readjusting to life in the United States after your service, when you came back to the U.S.
I don't know. It was hard to adjust to civilian life. Once you get out the military, it's like the whole purpose is gone. All you could think is about your military, the buddies that are still serving, your friends that are deployed, just everything. Like, you wish you could be there again, and that's one thing that once I got out, I was going to wait about a year, and if things weren't looking too good for me, I was going to enlist again. I was going to join to the military, but things happened, and That didn't happen for me,
When you were deported, I understand that it came after an incident where you were charged with a crime. Tell me about that.
Correct. I got out the military in 2000 and the end of, I think it was 2004 I got out. I had trouble readjusting back to with society, it wasn't the same. It was hard to get a job and everything. It's just so, and I was battling my own little demons from the service, so I started drinking, smoking, just whatever I could do to escape. And then sooner or later, I started having run-ins with the law, even if it was little things like speeding or whatever, a year after service, I did get in trouble with the law, and I ended up catching a federal case, and I was charged with aiding and abetting to a kidnapping and a gun charge in 2006.
And you served a long time in prison for this.
Correct. I got 10 years, but I did get out in good conduct release, and after 9 years. They released me, and I thought I was going home. I asked all the time, is there any ICE holds on me or anything like that? Am I going to get deported? And the counselors, everybody in the federal prison system, they said, no, you're going home. And when I came out, when I was about to walk out the door, they said, hold up, you got an ICE hold. ICE is going to come pick you up. And that's just what happened. ICE came to pick me up, and they took me to an ICE hold facility where I found my deportation for about 10 months through my military service. And to no avail, I was deported. In 2015, I was deported. I was 2016.
Yeah, I think
deported.
2016. So you've been in Mexico for quite some time now. I think probably a lot of people hearing this story would be very surprised by this, that you were in prison for 9 years. You served your time. Prior to that, you served your country in the military. And you're telling me that you weren't even given warning that this was a possibility, that when you got out of prison, that there was going to be an attempt to deport you.
Correct. Yeah, because usually I would ask around and they said, no, within a year before you come out of prison, you'll have ICE contact you and telling you that they're going to pick you up and all that. But nothing happened till the very end when I was about to walk out the door from the federal prison. They said, oh, wait, you got a hold. ICE is going to pick you up.
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I understand that a Yale Law School program for veterans is helping you with an application to become a citizen so that you can return to the U.S. Tell me about that.
Oh, yes. They filed the N-400 for me, which is a citizenship through my military service. Not just military service, but a combat deployment and all that. I filed myself back when I was in ICE holding, and I passed the biometrics, the test that they give you, a Homeland Security, the test they give you for citizenship. I passed all that, but they ended up disqualifying me. They said I could never prove in my life that I had good moral character because of that one incident, that felony. So they denied my N-400 at that time. And now laws have changed. Laws change. And now the door opened where I could file the N-400, and I'm not barred from citizenship now. So, there's hope now. Before there wasn't too much hope, but now there is hope that I will be coming home.
And we should point out, as I understand it, you were eligible to become a citizen while serving in the Army, but you didn't get the help to do that.
Yeah, when I first enlisted, the recruiter told me, this is going to make you a citizen. And I was like, okay. Hey, all right. I was 18, 19 years old. I was like, yeah, okay, that's not why I did it. I did it to serve my country. And to me, the U.S. was already my country, you know? So that was a plus of citizenship, I guess, you know? But in 2002, before I deployed, and before deployment, I decided, you know what? I'm going to look into my citizenship. I'm going to see what's going on. I'm going to go check my status. And so I started asking my chain of command, how do I become a citizen? How do I verify I'm a citizen? Like, where do I go? And nobody in my chain of command knew where to tell me where to go. One of my NCOs told me, go speak to the JAG office, the JAG officers, the lawyers and all that on post. And so I went over there, and to no avail, they just told me, we don't know anything about that. They couldn't tell me where to go. And I said, I got to get ready for it to deploy. I got to make my will. I got to just prepare, we were pre-deployment already. We were getting ready to deploy like in the next month or so. So I just kind of said, if I survive, if I come back for more, I'll look into it again. And when I came back, I didn't have that opportunity.
Did people who you were serving with know your story, that you only were in Mexico as a young child, as I understand it, that you were in Las Cruces at age 8 or 7 or 8, right?
Yeah, I was age 7.
Age 7. So, I mean, the U.S. is home. I mean, I'm guessing that, I think back to when I was 6 or 7, I don't remember hardly anything from right. That long ago. I can't imagine the situation you were in, how you felt, what was happening, how you managed. Take me back to 2016 when you thought, you know, you're getting out of prison, you can start your life over, and instead you're sent to another country. It's not your home anymore. You know, it's not the U.S. It's Mexico.
Oh man, it's the worst feeling ever. it's especially when the final hearing for my immigration case, the district attorney for Homeland Security, when my lawyer and then passed on my military record, my service record, he said, he just pushed it to the side, didn't even look at it. He said, his service doesn't matter to this country. Good luck in Mexico. That's one of those, that's the worst feeling ever right there. That's for sure. especially while my time in service, I was a great soldier. You know what I mean? I volunteered for everything. I did a lot of, I gave it all. You know, you lose all your youth to the military. I got numerous awards, always won competitions, inspections. I was a great soldier. I was an NCO. I had soldiers under me. It's awful. It's like they just ripped your heart out. You know what I mean? I was ready to die for the country. And then this happened. So, yeah, it's awful feeling. I don't wish it upon nobody.
I understand that you're not alone, that you live in Juarez with other deported veterans in a support house. This is when I first read your story quite some time ago. I read about this. Tell me about that.
Yes, when I first got deported in 2016, I mean, I came to Juarez, nowhere to go, didn't know anybody, you know what I mean? I have family down here, but at the same time, I've been gone so long, it's, you don't really know them, you know? And in this situation, the only ones that you only can associate with people that are going through the same thing. So I isolated myself from the family I did have down here. You become very suicidal the first couple of months because they tell you can never come back to the United States. The only way is in a body bag. So sometimes you think that's the best option, you know, like just whatever, I want to go home no matter what. but yeah, so I was deported like already for 6 months, and I started just Googling deported veterans and stuff like that. And it led me to a site for a deported veteran support house, Tijuana. And I contacted Hector Barajas right away. And I told him, hey, I'm deported. I'm down here in Juarez. Is there any assistance for deported veterans down here? And he told me no, but there is a group of veterans down in Juarez. And I started reaching out to them. And before we know it, we started with the help of course, Hector Barajas. We started the Deported Veteran Support House Juarez, and first we started with like five veterans. From there, we started growing. We start like my job. What I do is help veterans file their VA claims, seek their benefits, and often I do fundraisers, take donations, and I distribute it to the other deported veterans in need.
Has that helped you having that support of other men that are in your shoes?
Well, yeah, so it's helped a lot, you know. You still have that brotherhood that exists between veterans. So, and then we're all going through the same thing, the same battle. So we still have that brotherhood that, you know, it just feels like I'm back at home in the States sometimes with my brothers, you know. We're all going through the same battle. We're living the same life. And that's my motivation. I became one of the advocates here for deported veterans. I've done numerous interviews, documentaries, everything. And I the way I see it, if I can't come home myself, I will help others to come home.
You can watch my complete interview with Ivan Okan tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV's Newsmakers. You'll also find it on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. Speaking of veterans, a new law could help the roughly 1.5 million veterans living in Texas get academic credit for skills they learned in the military. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports.
The new law aims to create a universal catalog to translate which military training could apply to which degree and certificate programs at Texas trade schools and colleges. Democratic State House Rep. Alex Dominguez of Brownsville co-authored the bill. He says it's about reducing redundancy for veterans and giving them quicker entry into the civilian workforce.
For example, a veteran might be leaving military service and having always done work in, say, infantry, but they might notice that they have developed enough skills that would help them get a job in, say, law enforcement or to be a paramedic.
Dominguez says the Texas Workforce Commission will work with the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board to complete the catalog, hopefully by January 2023. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Conservation groups are applauding a court ruling that will require the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to address poaching in its Mexican gray wolf recovery plan. Here's Roz Brown from the New Mexico News Connection.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has 6 months to develop new language in its Mexican gray wolf recovery plan after a judge ruled the problem of illegal killing of wolves was not adequately addressed. The judge's ruling was in response to a lawsuit by conservation groups, including Defenders of Wildlife. Southwest Program Manager Brian Bird says one of the highest sources of wolf mortality is poaching by humans, and protections are needed for that.
Whether that's increased law enforcement or increased education of the public, they have to put those into the recovery plan explicitly.
The group's 2018 lawsuit claimed that the federal agency's plan failed to meet basic requirements of the Endangered Species Act. Mexican gray wolves, or lobos, became one of the most endangered mammals due to federally sanctioned hunting, trapping, and poisoning. According to Bird, the centuries-long coexistence conflict between wolves and humans, especially over territory and livestock, has nearly led to their extinction.
You're never supposed to shoot a wolf unless you're under extreme threat for personal safety or property. And when you lose a wolf to poaching, it's very likely it could be highly valuable from a genetic perspective.
Bird says genetic diversity has decreased dramatically among the Mexican gray population, and a proper recovery plan could help save the wolves from extinction. He adds that 105 gray wolves are known to have been killed unlawfully between 1998 and 2019 following their reintroduction to New Mexico and Arizona. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
In order to increase voting access, a new state law requires each New Mexico county to provide one secure ballot drop box for every 25,000 voters with a minimum of two. The Bernalillo County Clerk disagrees with the Secretary of State's office about what that means. KUNM's Nash Jones explains.
Bernalillo County Clerk Linda Stover says the county has met the state's requirement for the upcoming local election.
I talked to my legal counsel about this when these drop boxes came about. He told me I was only required to have two. I will only have two.
However, Mandy B. Hill, election director with the Secretary of State's office, says that while all counties must have at least two drop boxes, the minimum for each is based on the voter population formula. That would require Bernalillo, the state's most populous county, to have 17 boxes based on the most recent voter registration data. B. Hill says with only two,
they are not meeting the minimum as required in our administrative rule.
Stover says she disagrees with B. Hill's interpretation of the policy and that her county is already in compliance in terms of the number of drop boxes they provide. While the minimum is in reference to the permanent secure containers, Stover emphasized that Bernalillo County provides temporary ballot drop boxes within each of its 72 election day polling locations.
For our population, that is plenty.
Vigil says her office will work with counties to come into compliance by next year's primary election. For KUNM, I'm Nash Jones.
As we told you recently, Doñana County has seven ballot drop boxes, exceeding the state requirement. In Las Cruces and across the country, school boards and school board elections have been inundated with falsehoods about efforts to create a more inclusive curriculum. Some thoughts from commentator Peter Goodman.
There's one human race, Homo sapiens. Black, white, yellow, and red are varying skin pigmentations, not races. Race was a concept used to justify slavery and other forms of exploitation of fellow humans. Race was central at our country's formation and is its greatest flaw. Whites held black slaves. States backed that law with laws and armed slave catchers. Every state denied blacks, women, and poor folks the right to vote, and our Constitution made each Southern slaveholder's vote more powerful than a Northerner's. We've tried to escape systemic racism. We even fought a war. We've made great strides. But so-called racial bias is still systemic, not only in certain states' new voting laws, but all around us. Hiding photos of a black family and removing Afro-American-themed books and art can double the home's appraised value. Prospective employers call job candidates named Emily Granchester and Greg Windham 50% more often than they call Letitia Washington and Jamal Jones, despite equal qualifications. And you've heard of John Gruden. Some folks say our country is colorblind. That's wishful thinking, or their own willful blindness. Some educators are trying to get more real. Let's love our country, but face its flaws. But Texas reacted with HB 3979, and now frightened teachers are scrambling to find books giving the opposing perspective on the Holocaust. Will they have to teach the earth revolving around the sun as a theory? In families or workplaces, it's clear that frankly discussing problems and differences can clear up misunderstandings, helping everyone. Holding negative feelings inside lets them fester into something worse. Some fear of the other is natural, but the cure is getting to know strangers. Racism is in most all of us as something to outgrow. Facing that is healthier than leaving questions and confusion lurking about in kids' hearts. Shouldn't distract them from learning the rules of grammar, and it could add interest to a class on the Declaration of Independence. Facing historic notions of superiority for what they were could be thought-provoking. To quote from a TED Talk called What I Learned from My White Grandchildren, quote, "When we talk about race with our children, we don't burden them, we free them." Locally, responding to the Azzie Martinez case, the school system is working on Policy JBC, which aims to increase equity in education by, among other things, more open discussion. There's also, here as elsewhere, an organized right-wing effort to kill JBC. The opponent's stated fear is that by opening up discussions, we'll divide kids rather than uniting them. Ironically, to me, they quote Martin Luther King and say such policies retreat from the colorblind society he sought, that we all sought. I don't agree, but hope to keep lines of discussion open with those folks. Meanwhile, your vote for school board could affect how all this plays out, one way or the other.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. More on this topic from commentator Walt Rubel later in the show. The inaugural 10x25 Creativity Conference took place at the Las Cruces Convention Center earlier this month. The conference brought together local entrepreneurs, artists, educators, and politicians for a chance to share their stories and inspire more people to follow their passions. KRWG Public Media scholar Noah Race reports.
With such a diverse and unique group of people at the 10x25 Creativity Conference, keynote speaker Beto Paredes hopes some of the ideas shared will become a reality.
Well, the Creative Conference is really about bringing people together at the intersection, metaphorically, of I-10 and I-25. It really is bringing together business entrepreneurship as well as the arts. And in many ways, entrepreneurship is more like art than it is science.
Paredes is no stranger to entrepreneurship. Having started many successful endeavors, he now teaches at New Mexico State University.
I also worked as a telecom executive throughout Latin America. I worked on Wall Street and then a few other things and went back for school and eventually launched the first regional venture fund in this region of the Southwest. And about 3 years ago, I started teaching entrepreneurship at New Mexico State University.
One example of the mix between art and entrepreneurship can be seen in Jerry Prochazka's video game development company, Ganymede Games, based in Las Cruces.
We're an independent game development studio, started with the kind of industry veterans here in Las Cruces, of all places. We did a multi-state tour, Arizona, Texas. We're thinking about even going back to California, but fell in love with Las Cruces, and that's how we got here.
Local musicians also attended the Creativity Conference. Artist, model, and musician A. Billy Free shared her journey as a businesswoman and where she hopes to be in the future.
I've been doing music since a little girl. Going into college, I went to a liberal arts school. It didn't really click for me that music could be a career. So after I finished my studies, I was always still involved in music and bands and stuff. But after I finished my studies, I said, hey, you know, I can make a livelihood from this.
An often misunderstood aspect of entrepreneurship is networking. Tech and sales professional Otilio Reyes says networking combined with persistence is key to a successful business.
Usually when people hear the word networking, you think of going to events where you just hand out business cards and connect with as many people as possible. I think that is a key component of networking, but I think networking goes a little farther. When you connect with somebody and you're really genuinely interested, you learn from them. And then if you start thinking of those people, when you're connecting with other people, you're able to connect people to opportunities.
The 10 by 25 Creativity Conference allows local professionals a chance to share their wisdom. And the speakers have lots of advice for people just starting out.
In the random walk that is everybody's upbringing and life, looking at that randomness in retrospect, you find that every opportunity, every challenge, every setback is really a defining moment for you to make new decisions and find your path. That randomness really creates a tapestry of really beautiful things.
Creativity is often one of those skills that seems in many ways like a high risk, but a lot of the world's problems that we actually are encountering require creativity. I mean, a lot of the problems and a lot of the opportunities are things we've never done before. And the only way to really do something you haven't done before is through creativity.
You don't have to have a lot of material things. You can use what you have and sort of build off of that. And for me, that is a lot more rewarding when you're not going out sort of breaking the bank. You just use what you have, use your own networking skills, use life skills in order to build your career.
I think this is a great conference for Las Cruces. I think there is a lot of really interesting people here that are very smart. I think if we incentivize entrepreneurship and keep kind of bringing some of these type of conference into the region, we can kind of open Las Cruces up to some of the things that are available out there.
The 10 by 25 Creativity Conference highlights the important connection between entrepreneurship and creativity. With more events in the future, hopes that this conference will grow into something bigger are on the rise. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Noah Race.
On the Health Watch this week, SB 8 became law last month in Texas and blocks abortions as early as 6 weeks before most women know they're pregnant. While the legal fight over the law continues, Texans who can get pregnant but don't want to right now are weighing their options. As Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports, that can be tough for those in the state who lack a strong sex education, health insurance, supportive doctors, or all of the above.
Growing up in San Antonio, Victoria Acuna's family didn't really talk about reproductive health or preventing pregnancy.
My house was like a Latin household. The only thing my dad ever said was like, protect your body. And then that was it.
She started taking birth control pills when she was in high school, initially because the hormones reduced acne, but it made her depression worse.
It made me feel a little more emotional, made me feel a little more scattered. And it also just made me feel a little more upset about things.
Acuna now goes to college in Colorado and through the university's clinic got a Nexplanon implant in her upper arm. The small, rod-shaped implant will release ovulation-preventing hormones for up to 5 years.
It's been really helpful in just, like, regulating periods and removing that fact of having to take something every day. It's already there, and you don't have to worry about it, and I've really enjoyed it so far.
While Acuna says she had a great experience with her doctor, that's not the case for everyone exploring birth control options. Julia Weiss started looking into getting an intrauterine device, or IUD, last year, after she graduated from college in San Antonio. Her first doctor had a few extraneous questions.
The doctor, he was like an old man, was like, well, are you sure, like, you want to have babies soon, right? Like, are you married? Like, you and your husband, you want to have babies? And I was like, no, like, that's not your any of your business.
She found a more supportive clinic and had the procedure in 2020.
I think it was probably, like, one of the most painful things I've experienced in my life, and I've, like, broken bones. So, but it's something that I would do again, and I would do it every year if I needed to.
IUDs are inserted through the cervix into the uterus, where they block sperm from fertilizing eggs. Some types can last up to 10 years. Weiss says that appealed to her, especially because she lives in Texas.
It was kind of this idea of, like, well, you never really know. What if birth control is next? Like, what if I'm not going to be able to have access to this? Like, I might as well get the one that lasts as long as possible.
Another obstacle people face when seeking birth control is access to affordable health care. Texas has the highest number and percentage of people without health insurance in the country, and state lawmakers again declined to expand Medicaid during the most recent legislative session. Carrie White is with UT Austin, where she leads the Texas Policy Evaluation Project.
There is a great need in the state for funding and programs that enable people, particularly those who are living on low incomes, to be able to obtain the contraceptive method that they would like to use.
White says the state's decade-long crackdown on abortion providers like Planned Parenthood has also made it harder for people to obtain other contraceptives, something those clinics often also provide.
All of the instability that has taken place in Texas over the last decade related to the availability of contraceptive methods and services can be linked to the efforts by state legislatures to try to curtail access to abortion. And so these are points that are interrelated.
The state's puritanical approach to reproductive health extends from the clinic to the classroom. Public schools in Texas are not required to teach sex education classes. If they do, they must promote abstinence as the best choice before marriage. That's what Myra D. experienced growing up in rural East Texas.
It was a lot of abstinence-only programming. That was the only programming that ever came through my high school.
Dee says the pervading societal expectation there was that kids grow up, get married, and have their own kids. She was never interested in that path.
So my family back in East Texas is just very much like, don't worry, you'll get there, you'll want kids. And so I'm just like, well, no. I know you think that, but no.
Since high school, Dee's been interested in sterilization surgery that permanently prevents pregnancy. When she got to college in Abilene, she asked her doctor about it.
She said flat out that no doctor is going to take me seriously until I'm at least 25 on this request.
Dee tried several other contraceptive options, but was still determined. When she turned 25, she worked with her doctor to find an obstetrician gynecologist willing to perform the sterilization procedure.
The relief that I had when I had my surgery and knowing what I had done, like, there was just so much contentness, and I felt this relief that I couldn't even begin to describe.
But she's still frustrated over how hard it can be for someone to take control of their reproductive health, especially now, with Texas effectively banning most abortions.
It's their right. And to see that being stripped away just angered me, and it hurt. And it's heartbreaking to know that that choice has been taken away from them.
I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in San Antonio.
Also on the Health Watch this week, a good reason to take care of yourself that could be lurking inside you. You could have diverticulosis without knowing it. But Dr. Ariel Ade with UT Southwestern Medical Center told KERA's Sam Baker poor lifestyle choices could produce different outcomes.
Diverticulosis refers to the presence of small outpouchings in the colon, so called diverticula, or little sacs. Little sacs develop in the wall of the GI tract, most commonly in the large intestine.
This is sort of the first step toward diverticulitis.
Diverticulitis refers to a complication of diverticulosis, one of these little outpouchings or sacs becoming inflamed and infected, and can have a number of complications after that. The vast majority of patients with diverticulosis will not develop diverticulitis. Diverticulitis develops in less than 5% of patients with diverticulosis.
But as it pertains to diverticulosis, the way you described it sounds as if it would be uncomfortable, but it's not. How is it that so many people can have it and not know it?
So this is just a structural finding. It could be seen on a routine screening colonoscopy or even a CAT scan that they could have performed for something else. It's a condition that increases as we age. So more than 50% of patients greater than age 60 in the U.S. will have diverticulosis. And then more than 70% of patients greater than age 80 will have some degree of diverticulosis. It's much less common, 1 or 2% in patients less than age 30 would have diverticulosis.
But still, that's quite a few people to have it. Why and how does that happen?
So the exact mechanism for the development of diverticulosis is unknown, but there are a number of different proposed mechanisms for the development, including muscular atrophy in the colonic wall, collagen abnormalities, connective tissue disorders, and then chronic constipation or spasm and intestinal dysmotility. So all of those are proposed mechanisms for increasing the development of diverticulosis.
How long could a person have or live with diverticulosis before detecting some type of sign that something is amiss?
The vast majority of patients would live their whole lives without having any sort of complication.
So is there a reason then to be concerned about having diverticulosis at all?
The reasons to be concerned would be, that there is a risk for complications, and there are ways that we reduce those complications. So increasing your dietary fiber has been shown to decrease the risk of complications. Reducing obesity, sedentary lifestyle is a risk factor for diverticulitis and diverticular bleeding. Smoking is also a risk factor for chronic NSAID use, so ibuprofen, Aleve, naproxen, they increase your risk of complications. And then chronic opioid use is another risk factor for complications.
In the event, though, that a complication from diverticulosis does occur, is this something that can be treated?
Absolutely. Most of the times we treat that condition with antibiotics, but the more serious presentations usually require hospitalization, antibiotics, and imaging to ensure that there's no perforation or abscess. If an abscess forms, which would be an infected fluid collection outside the wall of the colon, then that might require drainage. If a perforation occurs, then that might require surgical intervention. Once the dust settles after an episode of diverticulitis, patients may have complications. So those would also require a surgical intervention.
So again, this is something that could be avoided, though, if that's what I'm hearing correctly.
Yes. Do know that there are things that we can do that are fairly easy interventions to reduce the risk of those complications.
Dr. Ade, thank you so much for being with me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
On the Business Watch next week, job seekers in Doñana County have a chance to meet with employers who are hiring in the area to learn more about an upcoming Las Cruces job fair. Anthony Moreno talked with Peter Martinez with New Mexico Workforce Connection.
New Mexico Workforce Connection, in partnership with the City of Las Cruces, is hosting a job fair Thursday, November 4th from 9:30 in the morning until 12:30 p.m. at the Las Cruces Convention Center. Here to share more about this event is Peter Martinez. He is an area manager with New Mexico Workforce Connection. Mr. Martinez, thank you for joining us.
Anthony, it's my pleasure. I appreciate you for this opportunity to be able to speak a little bit more in depth about the upcoming event that we're going to have. This is going to be our second in-person job fair of the year. We're really excited to partner again with the City of Las Cruces Economic Development Department, and we're hoping to put on a great event.
Can you share with us what industries will be at this job fair recruiting potential employees?
Right now we have healthcare, law enforcement, production, manufacturing, home healthcare, transportation, solar energy, hospitality, our main industries that we currently have set up right now at this time. The registration for employers will remain open until November 3rd, till 12 p.m. that day. So also, Anthony, I want to share if there's any employers, you know, that are wanting to participate, that would like to have a table at the convention center on the 4th of November, they can go to our website, which is employnm.com/post/job-fair-110421. We will have room there for employers to be able to conduct on-the-spot interviews. So we highly recommend any job seeker that will be attending the event to bring their updated resume, dress professionally, and be ready to interview. You know, we have a lot of excited employers that are hoping to be able to hopefully find some great candidates at this event. We also will be holding a free workshop for resume building. So any job seekers that need assistance in tailoring a resume, we will have, my staff will be on site to be able to assist those job seekers. We'll have printers on site to be able to print out those resumes for them, so that way they can present themselves well to any employers that are at the event.
What are some things that job seekers can do to help make a great first impression with recruiters at this event?
You know, I think just bringing up, you know, a great demeanor. You know what I mean? It starts with the way that they're dressed, you know. So obviously come in, you know, business professional, an updated resume, you know, tailoring their past experience of employment is fantastic, their education. You know, if they have a college degree, would be great to also have transcripts on hand with them. Any letters of recommendation would be fantastic as well. You know, any certifications that they have that can also add to their resume is also encouraged for them to bring. Again, just bringing in that great demeanor, that positive demeanor, and being excited to reenter the workforce, you know what I mean? It's going to get them on the right foot. But again, if there's any assistance that they need with the tailoring of a resume or preparing with some soft skills for interviews, my staff will be on site and we'll be more than happy to help out any job seeker.
Peter Martinez is an area manager with New Mexico Workforce Connection. They are putting on a job fair in partnership with the City of Las Cruces Thursday, November 4th from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Las Cruces Convention Center. Mr. Martinez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony, for your time. I appreciate it.
Another commentary on a story making news here in New Mexico and across the country. New Mexico is revising its standards for social studies instruction. Other states are doing this too. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Ruppel.
A great nation is able to teach its history honestly, celebrating its triumphs and correcting its mistakes. That's what the New Mexico Public Education Department is trying to accomplish with its proposed revision to the social studies standards. The revision comes at a time when school districts throughout the nation are going through the wrenching process of reevaluating how we look at our past and its impact on who we are today. In the 1970s, several legal scholars began writing about the role that white supremacy has played in advancing the interests of white people in the United States over those of minorities. It was called critical race theory. Today, CRT has become shorthand on the political right for any discussion about race that might make white people uncomfortable. The state's proposed revision is not CRT. But it does place a strong emphasis on our cultural and racial differences at every level of the process. Kindergartners would be taught to describe ways they are similar and different from people who share their identities and people who do not. Seventh grade students would be asked to brainstorm ways in which New Mexicans might heal from past and current injustices. I don't quibble with the historical accuracy of the proposed curriculum, but I'm worried that if not presented correctly, it could focus too much on our differences and not enough on our commonalities. The success of this new curriculum will depend on having teachers who understand their students and are able to explain complex and controversial subjects in a way that is nuanced and respectful of differing positions. I hope the PED will give teachers that freedom. I'm always suspicious of any grand new edicts that flow from the state capitol to the schoolhouse. We saw the dangers of that recently in neighboring Texas, when school librarians were told that a new state law required them to present opposing views to any books they may have on historical events, even the Holocaust. So, Mein Kampf? Despite my misgivings, it's clear that the new curriculum would provide a comprehensive study of who we are and how we got here. Much of it would be specific to our state, heritage, and culture. And all of it is designed to encourage students to think critically about issues and be able to rationally make and support their own decisions. The plan is still in the draft phase at this time, and the public comment period is still open. I fear that many of those commenting have not read the plan, which is available on the PED website. I encourage anyone who's concerned about what you've heard about the plan to read it yourself first, and then add your voice to the discussion. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. It's perhaps one of the most misunderstood art forms, spray paint art, seen across any major city. Artists express themselves freely, and some are now able to do so, not only with permission, but encouragement. It should be noted, what we're going to be hearing about right now is just that, not art that is produced without permission. Here's KRWG public media scholar Noah Race.
Las Cruces artist Saba uses his surroundings to help inspire his artwork.
So from being from the Southwest, being from here, I love to incorporate the landscape. Just a lot of artifacts and different things that represent the Southwest is what I call Southwest wild style. And it really just comes from growing up here.
Saba often draws on past experiences. Being an indigenous person, he practices traditions that are part of his heritage.
Back to the Southwest wild style, we want to establish that we've been practicing these ways and this culture prior to New York and the East Coast existence on this land. Meaning that we've danced, made beats, told stories, and wrote on walls, which is the four elements of hip-hop. The Waco Tank's just an old-school graffiti art, in my opinion.
Graffiti art and hip-hop culture often go hand-in-hand. Hip-hop culture values freedom, expression, social justice, and enjoying life. Graffiti is one way of expressing and celebrating these values. For Saba, this culture helped him become who he is today.
As long as I practice doing this art form, I don't have to practice being a drunk Indian or any of those stereotypes that my community that I come from has. It's just like, you know, it's just like sketching in a sketchbook, but at a bigger scale. You know, it's really just making a mess and cleaning it up. There's nothing to it, really. If it doesn't look good, you can totally erase it and go over it, you know? But a lot of the times, that's where the originality and the style come from, is the mistakes.
Graffiti art has not always been fully accepted. Often, it was associated with vandalism and street gangs. In more recent years, graffiti art is being viewed with a more open mind, leading to a rise in popularity.
It's awesome that, you know, the mainstream has finally caught on to the healing and how hard the art form is. Like you said, how does one get into it? You practice, right? How does one spin on their head and break dance? They practice, you know. How does one drive? You know, you gotta get in the car and drive.
Saba practiced this style by watching his brother and his friends create graffiti around their city of Farmington in northern New Mexico. He credits them for introducing him to his passion.
They were the local hooligans that, you know, tagged their territory, and it was always an awesome thing to know that, you know, that I knew who did that. They crushed our little town, and it was cool just knowing that, you know, you were able to even do something like that and low-key get away with it. Yet to really figure out, you know, the harm some of that culture does, you know, but they weren't taught by themselves to act that way.
Overall, Saba says hip-hop culture and graffiti are positive influences on the world. He says they provide a means of expression that many low-income and underprivileged groups do not get.
Shout out to all my aunts and uncles and parents and people that have encouraged me and told me that I could do anything, right? And paid the rent and did what they had to keep me alive, right? Because I think that's what we're protecting, is our soul, our traditions, our culture, our timeline, our knowledge of these ways of life that we practice every day, right? Whether it's painting graffiti or praying in the kiva, it's the same thing going on.
Graffiti and street art are more than just paint on a wall to the artist. It means they have a chance for expression, to illustrate their thoughts and emotions. This often controversial art form is a vital outlet for artists like Saba, who are invited to share their vision with the world. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Noah Race.
Finally this week, the history of indigenous voting will soon be on exhibit at the New Mexico History Museum. Here's Roz Brown from the New Mexico News Connection.
As recently as 1962, New Mexico suppressed indigenous voting rights on the basis that Native Americans living on reservations were not residents of the state. New Mexico History Museum Executive Director Billy Garrett says 15 years prior to that, indigenous people were kept away from the polls with the argument that they did not pay taxes.
The fact that Native Americans had to sue to get the right to vote as late as the 1940s is something I don't think most people know about.
Garrett says the exhibit will highlight the story of Miguel Trujillo Sr., a Marine sergeant in World War II. He returned to New Mexico and waged a successful legal battle to overturn the state law that barred American Indians living on reservations from participating in elections. Despite guaranteed voting rights in the U.S., Native Americans, especially those who live on reservations, face obstacles. They may travel for many hours to cast ballots because reservations lack voting sites or reliable mail service. Several states also have enacted voter ID laws requiring that people have a traditional street address, although that's not common on reservations. Garrett says museum exhibits often reveal the complexity of the nation's past.
There are things that have happened in our history that tend to get buried. They tend to get forgotten. So this is an important part of that process of making sure we understand the way that our country works.
He says the Santa Fe Museum will use grant money from the National Endowment for the Humanities to develop the exhibit, including hiring Native American scholars to research the project. The NEH has recently awarded nearly $88 million in American Rescue Plan relief funding for economic recovery to cultural and educational institutions. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.